This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I am Chris Policano. DC 37 represents 125,000 city employees, 25,000 private sector care workers, and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone or tablet and search for DC 37 State of the Union. There are now more ways to stay in touch with the union. You can visit our website, www.dc37.net. You can follow us on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you have any comments about our show or would like us to help you promote a community event, please drop us a line at State of the Union. That's one word, State of the Union at dc37.net. This is Thanksgiving weekend 2019. I hope you all had a great holiday with friends and family. Tonight, we begin a two-part conversation about one of the most vexing issues of the 21st century, economic inequality. We're doing this over two consecutive broadcasts because we wanted to be able to take the time for a thoughtful conversation, and one of the priorities of these 60 minutes is speaking as plainly as possible. What triggered this conversation is the lead sentence of a recent news article. The sentence reads, quote, "The wealth gap in the United States continues to widen, with the top 1% of Americans close to amassing more wealth than the entire middle class, according to the latest data from the Federal Reserve," end quote. What that sentence means, how we got here, and what the implications are for the future are what we're going to spend this show and the next show talking about. Joining me in the studio are Professor Janet Gornick, Director of Stone Center on Socioeconomic Inequality at CUNY. Welcome to State of the Union.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
James Parrott is the Director of Economic and Fiscal Policies at the New Schools Center for New York City Affairs. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you, Chris.
And by phone from Washington, D.C., is a fellow who's been on this program regularly, AFSCME's Director of Research, Steve Kreisberg. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Chris. Happy holidays. Pleasure to be back with you.
Since we're going to be talking about this over the course of two shows, I would like to spend this half hour talking in layman's terms about what economic inequality is and to provide some history about how we've come to this place and time. I'd like to start by asking Professor Gornick to help us define economic inequality and to give us your sense of how, during the past 10 to 15 years, inequality caught the nation's attention. Hasn't there always been economic inequality in this country? Isn't that true?
Well, that's an excellent question. There was certainly a very high level of economic inequality in this country about 100 years ago, what we often call the Gilded Age, and then a very famous reduction in economic inequality between the wars, and starting in about 1980, a remarkable increase in various forms of economic inequality. So I can talk a little bit more about exactly what I mean by that.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. I think it's just worth noting one thing without going down too much of a technical path. You started with a dramatic quotation about wealth inequality. So it's just important to note that the inequality conversation has been both about income inequality and wealth inequality. And they go hand in hand, but they're really quite different. They have different patterns. They're both very concerning. Income inequality, of course, is, as it sounds, about disparities across households and the amount of money that comes into a household every year. Wealth is, or it refers to assets, essentially, to what it is that people have. It could be financial wealth. It could be real estate wealth. In both cases, there's been an increase. And in both cases, we've been overwhelmed with these recent findings from new data sets and new research about how much the top 1% and the top 1% of the top 1% holds of both the income and wealth share. But it is important to note that they're different. About the bottom half of the distribution has no wealth at all. In fact, has debt. So they're just different questions. I think it's income inequality that has really attracted the most attention in the last decade or so.
James, would you like to weigh in on that?
So if you think about income inequality in New York City, we've certainly seen a dramatic change since the 1980s. One of the common measures of income inequality is the share of all income received in a year that goes to the top 1% of the population. The 99% is everybody else. The 1% share in New York City, like in the U.S., was around 10% in 1980. Today, the 1% share has risen, steadily. It's bumped up and down as with the economic cycles. But it's continued to rise, and it stayed very, you know, fairly high for the in recent years. In New York City, the 1% share is around 37% right now. Nationally, the 1% share has also grown a lot, but it's up around 22% or so. So there's a much greater degree of income polarization, of income inequality in New York City. And, you know, that reinforces the notion that we've always been a city of rich and poor, although the distance between the well-being of those two general concepts, right, rich and poor, has gotten much greater over time.
Well, did we just wake up one day and figure that out, that that was happening? And, I mean, how did we come to understand that? And how did we come to make that an issue for our time?
I think there's no question that in about the last 10 or 12 years, there's been a rise in national interest in income inequality. And by national, I mean among legislators, among journalists, among policymakers and academics. It's worth noting that public opinion polls show that sort of the general masses have always been interested in inequality. But in terms of really a lively and active conversation, it started in around the time of the crisis, I would say around 2008.
Okay.
And then we saw the Occupy movement, and there's been a lot of debate about what the consequences and the impact of the Occupy movement has been. But one thing I think we know for sure is that the movement caused a huge uptick in public conversation. In fact, there were some numbers on that, looking at the frequency with which the word inequality shows up in the press. And in the first 12 weeks after Zuccotti Park, it went up fivefold.
Okay, so let's slow that down. The Occupy movement is what?
The Occupy movement was, for the most part was, I guess it's been relatively quiet, a movement that cropped up in New York City and in many other countries around the world around 2012, I think it was, 2011, 2012, and of course coined the famous phrase, you know, we are the 99. Most of the Occupy activists made a conscious decision not to step into public policy, not to become a left-wing version of the Tea Party. So it was really a movement, a grassroots movement, but it attracted a huge amount of attention and all over the world, actually. There were Occupy demonstrations all over the world. And shortly after that, I would say, though, several things, it was sort of a perfect storm. New data sets cropped up, new books came out. The book by Piketty came out that everybody was talking about and few people read.
Right, it's a big book.
Definitely. And, you know, in my world, I work in an income inequality research institute. You know, our phone rang like crazy in ways that it hadn't in the years before. And then it all became cumulative. New institutions developed, new centers developed. The world, the level of interest now in income inequality and other forms of economic inequality is much greater than it was 10 years ago. And for those of us who work in the field, we're immensely gratified by this increase in interest and knowledge.
Okay, and I don't want to, I don't want to say it too simplistically, but it was a bunch of folks in public squares who just wouldn't leave. And what they were saying was, there is 1% and there's the rest of us, the 99%. There was a lot of criticism that I remember at the time about, well, what's this all about? And where is this movement going? And but what they did, the accomplishment of that movement, in my mind, is to have people thinking the way that thinking began. And I want to turn to Steve Kreisberg, who has been with us in spirit through this part of the conversation. Unions, like ours, have been talking about inequality for the longest of time. We owe a great debt to the Occupy movement for making the case that we were struggling with back in 2012. Would you agree with that, Steve, or not?
Well, I think there's obvious truth to that, right? I think when we look at as we emerged, or as we not even emerged, as the Great Recession deepened throughout 2009 through 2010, especially in the public sector, we were feeling the effects of that. I mean, government budgets were stretched to the breaking point. We were threatened with mass layoffs. In fact, the employment has been depressed in the public sector and is only now just recovering more than 10 years later. So, you know, to help make that case, we did have, you know, mass protests. And a lot of that was a reaction to the bailouts that were afforded to the banks. Yet we did not bail out workers. We did not bail out homeowners. We did not bail out pension funds that suffered. But we bailed out Goldman Sachs.
In fact,
that was the resentment, and I think that really crystallized it for a lot of folks. The wealthiest among us were those that got the benefit of government largesse.
And in fact, at that point in time, and I remember talking to progressive think tank folks who kept talking about the public employee pension problem, which was really going to be the big thing that hurt our economy moving forward. And I remember looking at people and saying, you can't really believe that. And until Occupy, I think that that whole conversation would have taken on a life of its own if there hadn't been a sense of, well, hold on a second, who's really got the money and what's really going on here? And I think the labor movement was able to take on from that, or take off from that. And you agree with that? Yes, sir?
Yeah, no, I think that Occupy played an important role. I don't think we should overstate it, though, because it was relatively short-lived. And I think we then entered a period led by, you know, the Obama administration, where we had some economic recovery. We had, you know, strong job growth, especially in the second term of President Obama's presidency. Yet the recovery was slow and painful for a lot of us. And, you know, we can't underestimate the impact that that has had. And I think when we think about the, our income inequality, much less wealth inequality, you know, it's hard to disentangle what's going on from our political system, because our political system had made deliberate choices. Professor Gornick mentioned that we had decreasing income inequality up until about 1980. In 1980, we elected a conservative president, Ronald Reagan, who adopted a whole new set of policies. And these policies very deliberately operated in a way to exacerbate income inequality and wealth inequality. And for instance, we've seen the policies undermine the ability of workers to exercise any kind of power through collective bargaining and labor unions. That was a deliberate policy foisted upon us during the Reagan administration, and we still suffer from it today. So union density has declined significantly, density meaning the percentage of workers who are covered by union contracts. So workers can't fight on even terms for their fair share of the economic pie. We've seen rises in productivity, but workers have not gotten their fair share of that rise in productivity. Other deliberate measures, public policy measures that have worked to depress worker wages include trade. As we move to so-called open trade, which isn't open at all, it just favors trade that undermines workers' wages. And so that has had a depressing effect on the ability of workers to claim their fair share of the economic pie.
Okay, let me just ask James to weigh in on that. We've got about another minute, and then after the break, we'll come back and talk.
Yeah, no, this is starting to get into a really important thing to realize. So a lot of people point to the broad changes in the economy, the increase in international trade, the increase in technology, and so on, and point to that as the source of growing income inequality and so on. What that really reflects is the failure of public policy to shape international trade, to shape the way technology progresses. It could be done in a way that benefits workers and the general population, or it could go to benefit corporate profits. It has certainly done the latter.
We're going to continue this conversation. The subject is income and economic inequality, and we'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. We're talking about income and economic inequality. In the studio with me are Professor Janet Gornick, Director of Stone Center on Socioeconomic Inequality at CUNY. James Parrott is the Director of Economic and Fiscal Policies at the New Schools Center for New York City Affairs. And by phone from Washington, D.C. is Steve Kreisberg, the Director of Research for AFSCME. We were talking about policies that affected or exacerbated economic income inequality. And Professor Gornick, you wanted to say something.
I wanted to pick up on the conversation about which policies and institutions shape income inequality. For the most part, we can leave wealth inequality aside for just a moment. It's important to note, James already noted that inequality in New York City is higher than in the U.S. And just to step back in general terms, inequality in the U.S. is higher than in almost every other rich country in the world, and it's risen more sharply in this period since 1980. In about two-thirds of the rich countries, income inequality has risen, in the U.S. more than in others. But in the other third, it's either been flat or even declined. And that's a really important sort of diagnostic window, if you will. We've already talked about the importance of trade and globalization and technological change. Those transnational forces matter. But the fact that as we look across similar countries, we see such dissimilar results tell us that that's not really the full explanation. Why would income inequality rise in Germany while it, was flat in France? Why would it rise in one Nordic country while it fell in the one right next door? The answer to that is that national policies matter, and they matter a lot. And what drives the very high income inequality in the United States, it's not a mystery. It may be a political mystery, but it's not a scientific mystery. We have a very low minimum wage. We have extraordinarily low union coverage, as you all know, way lower than in any comparable countries. We have a regressive tax system, one that's grown increasingly regressive. We have a meager and regressive system of income transfers. And we have very meager institutions and breaks in place on extremely high income and earnings at the top. So if I were queen for the day,
yes,
and could make some policy changes, I could cut income inequality in the U.S. In half.
And before we get to policy solutions, I want to stick on, because I really want this to be a conversation that helps people understand. And we use terms like globalization, for example, and I don't even quite understand what Steve, I'm going to throw this to you. When they're talking about how globalization has affected our members, what are they saying? I mean, what does that mean for our members?
Well, I think when you talk about globalization, it means many different things to many different people. But I think James hit it on the head. Trade in itself is not an evil, and we should not shun trade. But the trade policies that the United States has embarked upon typically protect the interests of capital at the expense of labor. And that's really a fancy way of saying we're favoring those who have wealth over those who do not. So, for instance, working people are often exposed to the competitive forces of the international economy, while those who have capital are not. For instance, we were actually going to expand the protections on intellectual property in the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, right?
Okay.
So what that means is big drug companies were going to get more years to shield themselves from competition. Now, how is that free trade? It's not free trade. So we should never even use that term.
Right.
Trade policies have very deliberately operated in a fashion to protect the wealthy. And I think what's happened now is having consolidated their economic power, the wealthy are now consolidating their political power. So it becomes for them a virtuous cycle and for the rest of us a vicious cycle.
Go ahead.
I guess just to finish up, so even public employees are affected by this because we have a regressive system of taxation, as Professor Gornick just pointed out, and therefore we do not have the means to fund our government, and we wind up with fewer public sector jobs than we need. We wound up paying public employees less than we should. We wind up underfunding pensions in many states. All of those things kind of conspire to depress even public employees who one might think initially would be relatively immune from the pressures of international competition.
James Parrott.
So just to pick up on that in terms of the how the effects in the broader international economy, global economy, how they affect public sector workers. So given that, you know, part of the political power of workers and labor unions in the United States was, you know, it's historically been rooted in like three sectors, in the public sector, in the building trades, and in manufacturing. Not surprisingly, the manufacturing, the strength of organized labor in manufacturing has been, you know, severely undermined by the effects of international trade and the failure to protect workers and communities that rely on manufacturing plants in the United States from the effects of, quote, free trade. So that weakening of organized labor in one sector has, you know, filtered into other sectors and makes it harder for public sector workers to defend their pensions because, you know, defined benefit pensions used to be very common in manufacturing among unionized workers. They're almost non-existent these days. That makes it much harder to protect defined benefit pensions and you know, good health insurance in the public sector.
I can just hear the conversation I had at Thanksgiving dinner with a couple of cousins who said, you know, we're trying to compete with people making 12 cents a year. You know, the American worker can't expect to get what the American worker used to be able to get because under globalization, we are now dealing with countries that pay their people very little, and we can't compete with that. Anybody want to respond to my crazy cousin from...
Well, I would tell your cousin that it would be worth taking a look at several important cases in Europe. I understand that your crazy cousin may think that Europe is represented by Greece and what happened there. That's what we often hear.
Socialism.
Is it Europe, all Greece? There are many countries in Europe that have high employment to population ratios, in other words, high rates of employment, higher than in the U.S., that have maintained a floor under wages. In the U.S., we have a very high share of low-wage workers, much higher than in most of the European countries. And, of course, the European economies have faced some challenges, but poverty is lower, inequality is lower. Health outcomes are better in many
in
cases.
In Europe than
in
they
many
are in
European
the United
cases.
States.
Not all of them, but in many. Debt to GDP ratios are lower. And so there are lots of other cases that are also exposed to as what we're now referring to as globalization and trade. I mean, those concerns about workers, you know, and enterprises moving to low-wage geographies, the whole world is dealing with that. But there are institutions and policies that can protect the workforces, unionized or otherwise at home, that the U.S. is simply not putting in place.
And so, again, because I wanted this segment to talk about how we got to where we are and your discussion of policies, there were, and Ronald Reagan's name, I think Steve brought up Ronald Reagan's name before, and Ronald Reagan, among other things, is known for having called the unions out with the PATCO strike, the famous PATCO strike. And that seems to, for whatever reason, in the mythology, have been this incredibly important moment in time where a bigger plan was being played out. And part of the plan was about breaking unions. And that the world view of Reagan's and his ilk was, again, going back to this idea of trickle-down economics, we had to make it from the top down. But if the top was getting, we would all eventually benefit from that. That was a worldview that you're saying policy actually was pushed to reinforce that. And James Parrott, how did that play out?
Well, that played out in a lot of ways. I mean, certainly the effect in weakening the power of workers, mainly through weakening the power of labor unions, led to decades where labor standards enforcement on minimum wage and wage and hour violations eroded. We have fewer fewer wage and hour inspectors at the federal level today than what we had when Ronald Reagan took office, because he came in and started to cut that back. We've also had a failure to increase the minimum wage. So along with the failure to adopt policies that allowed workers to share in some possible benefits of growing international trade, globalization, increased productivity through the use of technology, and so on. There's been a failure to protect workers from changes that employers have made in the employment relationship over time. There's a much greater use of independent contractors these days, where employers who can get away with treating workers as not my employee but my independent contractor, that basically strips away all employment rights and labor protections that workers have struggled for and won over the past century. So the failure to regulate labor standards, and then it goes into tax policy, the failure to regulate, enforce antitrust in a way that prevents the amassing of great monopoly power in large corporations and so on. You know, policy changes on a whole series of fronts have conspired to rig the system against the average person. And so, for example, in New York City, 2/3 of all the income gains in the 1980s and 90s went to the top 1%.
Professor.
We've been talking about the Ronald Reagan years, and those are important because that is the time that income inequality began to really soar in the United States during the 1980s. We don't want to blame Ronald Reagan for absolutely everything. There was plenty of malfeasance before and after. But the attack on the unions, you have to remember, went hand in hand. I think James mentioned there was a whole series of policy developments. Ronald Reagan invented the welfare queen, which began an attack on low-income families, especially those headed by single mothers, that was relentless, that led to the repeal of AFDC in the 1990s. He presided over a reduction in tax rates on the wealthy. He presided over several pieces of legislation that really led to soaring mass incarceration in this country. He presided over a destruction of a national housing policy. So many things happened in the 1980s. It was almost overdetermined. And the attack on the unions, of course, was just one piece of a patchwork of policy and institutional changes that were deliberate and consequential.
We've been talking about how we got to where we are now. We began with a sentence from a news article that said, "The wealth gap in the United States continues to widen, with the top 1% of Americans close to amassing more wealth than the entire middle class." And that was from data from the Federal Reserve. We're just about ready to end this show. I've got to do a couple of announcements before we go. The Education Fund is accepting applications for classes in the winter 2020 cycle, which begins in January. To submit an application, please visit www.dc37.net. And for more information, please call 212-815-1700. Also, if you want advice on attending college, make an appointment with a CUNY counselor or a DC37 counselor by calling 212-815-1700. Members, please check out the DC37 Rewards Program. Whether you purchase tickets to ball games or get an amazing price for a hotel room, look to do it through the Rewards Program and achieve real savings. To register, visit www.dc37rewards.com. The guest code is DC37YES. That's all caps. If you have any comments about this program or any of our shows, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I'm Chris Policano. We're going to continue this conversation next time. Until then, ciao.